All right, welcome back to the show. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Got a great show as always. And have another special guest. This is a guy that I've been looking forward to talking with. And we have talked. I've met him and hope to work in some capacity going forward with him because he's a very bright economic analyst and does some great research. And we've got him here today. See, I'm delaying the introduction. You hear this, Darren? See, I'm delaying. It's building up the anticipation here. so it is certainly the most scintillating hour of finance radio. And the reason we've got this guest with us today is we are going to do a deeper dive. We've done China specials before. We're going to do a deeper dive into China. And we're going to talk about, most importantly, or we're going to be taught, if you will, why we talk about China, why the focus is there. So without further ado, I want to introduce Chase Taylor, who's become a friend of mine and a great resource. And Chase is the proprietor of Pinecone Macro Research. And Chase, welcome to the show.
Hey, I appreciate it, Zach. It's great to be on with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I've been loving your work, loving the research you do, loving the way you come at things, different angles. Chase always also fits our guidelines for who we like to talk to, where you know, we've got no ego. It's a guy that's in it for the love of the work, and he goes where his nose leads him, and I just love the research. So anyway, Chase, let's start off right out of the gate. Markets, I've got a couple thoughts, but it really looked like we were going into our first bear market. We were right there at the end of December. We've seen this raging comeback here that looks like it's not going to stop. I'm looking at this right now, and it feels to me like we are headed to new all-time highs. The Fed has certainly still got our back. What's your take in general, what we're seeing in markets right now, and what's the outlook?
Yeah, so we definitely could be seeing new all-time highs here pretty soon, but I think we're going to hit some pretty significant technical resistance up at about where the last highs were. There's kind of a channel line that the S&P has been in since 2009, and it's going to test the top of that and the all-time high kind of at the same time. And considering rates and inflation have kind of been surprising a little to the upside, I think about that area could be a problem for the S&P coming up here shortly, but we'll see. Like you said, the Fed has the markets back, so if the Fed gets incrementally dovish every time they need to, maybe none of that will matter, and we'll just blast off the new highs.
Well, yeah, man, they're manufacturing prosperity, isn't it great? And I don't know what your take on it is, but one of the biggest regrets that I have is doubting central bankers' ability to keep this ball rolling. And the listeners are tired of hearing me pontificate. Maybe everybody is. My wife probably considers herself in that department as well. But the thing I keep coming back to is I regret my doubts that central bankers would be able to keep this on the rails. The other side of it, though, is recognizing that this is not a real market. I mean, bottom line, this whole bounce back we've seen, this rage up in stocks, the economy isn't warranting this, correct? And feel free to disagree with me, but this is completely a stimulus central bank run-up we've seen just again here in the last 3 months. Is that your take, and what do you think is the driving force behind that?
Yeah, it's absolutely not driven by the economy. In fact, the economy has been weakening, and I think if you look at a lot of the leading indicators and the data that's kind of looking forward, it's going to get worse. So that's it makes this time period a little bit interesting. But you know, going back to 2011 or 15 or 16, whenever the economy ran into problems, you know, the Fed was there to step in, and markets kept going higher. So I don't think there's any reason not to believe that the Fed is going to keep pushing things higher. With that said, one thing I think about the Fed maybe is a little different from a lot of folks is we always hear about the Fed put and that they're going to have the markets back and not let it go too far down. I'm starting to think there could be a bit of a Fed collar where they don't want it to get too high either. I fell for Jerome Powell's shtick whenever he took over. I thought he really cared about financial stability. I think a lot of us that thought that are second guessing whether that was ever true, but The Fed this past week actually talked a little bit more about financial stability. It sounded like maybe they are a little concerned. So the last couple cycles have really been, you know, they've ended whenever the stock market fell, more so than because of inflation. So I do think the Fed is worried that about having a blow-off top and that causing maybe the end of the cycle itself. So I wouldn't be surprised to see them get incrementally a little bit more hawkish just to keep the S&P sort of in a range as opposed to taking off too high or falling too low.
As long as we don't drop 20%, right? It's, yeah, I mean,
clearly.
the durability of that number over the last 10 years is just remarkable to me, right? I mean, we have stopped at 20% on the number, like what, three times now in the last 6 or 7 years? I mean, something like that. Maybe only twice. Maybe it was 16 and, but I mean, it just amazes me how that's the number it seems like they have targeted. Do you think that that's coincidence, or do you think there's something about that number? Is there, you know, I hate to be one of these plunge protection team guys, because I'm just not a big believer in that. It seems too conspiratorial to me. I kind of adopt Bill Fleckenstein's outlook on that. Like, look, you'd see trails, right? You'd see fingerprints, right, if that was the case. But this whole 20% max down thing is pretty interesting. Do you think there's anything to that, or is it just coincidence?
If there's anything to it, it's probably just the fact that they know that's the arbitrary bear market level, and they want to keep, you know, psychology kind of on side, and maybe they do defend that level a little more than others just based on that.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's get into the heart of the issue here. And this is really what I'm excited to talk to you about, and one of my biggest interests, the whole China issue. We've seen some interesting things in China. I think that part of this, and feel free to correct me if you disagree. I think a part of this run up is, I can't help but to recognize the similarities between what's happened in the last 3 months and what took place at the end of 2015 and the beginning of 2016. You know, gold popped bigger in 2015, 2016, but we've seen a similar response in gold. We're coming off a Fed hike in the middle of December. China starts pumping. That liquidity seems to be rising markets. What is your take? Now, and I will say this, though. The one thing that we're also seeing is it doesn't appear that the stimulus is having as big of an effect on the Chinese economy. So let's start from that 30,000 square foot view. And then I want you just to kind of take us down the rabbit hole on China. And but like I said, just start by addressing those things that I laid out and kind of tell us where we think we are at this moment as far as China's concerned.
Yeah, sure. So before I kind of dive into what's going on at the moment, one thing I want to definitely zoom out big time, just so all your listeners kind of fully understand why China is such a big deal in the global economy. And I want to make a comparison that kind of works for the folks in the Pacific Northwest. Everyone knows salmon. What they may not know is that salmon are a keystone species in the region. 137 different species depend on salmon. They bring a lot of nutrients in from the ocean and bring them up into the rivers and the forest. So everything from orcas to bald eagles to bears, even trees, depend on salmon. So they're that keystone one. And I think China is basically a global macro keystone. They've been responsible for so much of the growth, so much of the demand for commodities, and they're sort of the swing producer of liquidity in the world, which is the lifeblood of financial assets, which, like you were just talking about, what happened in like 2015-16, where China had a pretty nasty pullback and then floored it with liquidity, just printing tons of money and flooding the banking system. So, and then that, you know, the whole world took off after that. So you kind of see where, you know, guys like us pay a lot of attention to China because it is so important, and the swings in the global economy depend on China so much. And China's had a pretty significant, issue lately economically, engineered by themselves. And you kind of see what happens where Germany starts tanking, Europe has problems, the rest of emerging markets have problems, And we do feel it in the United States, just not as much as a lot of the rest of the world. But yeah, I just wanted to kind of highlight exactly why this is so important. But as far as what's going on right now in 2018 and 19 with China, I do think it is different from the last couple times where China had a big dip, just in that the amount of liquidity that they would have to provide to incrementally make a significant impact in their economy with the debt levels being so high, it just gets kind of exponential. So their choice at this point is to do an even bigger stimulus than they've done ever in the past in order to get the economy going, which, you know, is a big problem for China, because then all of a sudden they just have that much more debt, that much more dependence on liquidity, that much more leverage. And all those things are a very big long-term threat, something that China can't really afford to do if they want to become a rich country before they become a really old country. So it's just, I think they are taking reform more seriously than other people think right now, especially with the shadow banking industry. They've really tightened the clamps on that, and that's really how they got money into the system, because your private-owned businesses can't really get money from normal banks because they're looked at as too risky. So they had to go to the shadow banking world, and now they can't really do that as effectively because China's put clamps on shadow banking because it was so risky for their economy. So,
Chase, for the benefit of the listeners, give us a brief, just, you know, back of the envelope definition of what shadow banking is.
Yeah, so shadow banking is just any institution that can provide credit, you know, give you a loan that isn't actually in the formal banking system. So, you know, everything from like peer to peer to, you know, where you jump online and maybe you get some money from just another individual or financial institutions that aren't actual banks that are supported by the state, especially in China. So
it's like third party liquidity providers,
non-banks.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. So, and thank you guys so much for joining us. Just as a reminder, we're here with Chase Taylor from Pinecone Macro Research. And we're having our China discussion, which I hope you guys find as interesting as I do. So, Chase, you said that you think that they're taking structural reforms more seriously than most people. I right out of the gate, this is one of the reasons we got you on. I'm one of those people that thinks that the structural reforms are complete nonsense. Where am I wrong?
In the biggest way, I think it is a shadow banking, and as well as real estate. They, you know, they have a pretty epic real estate bubble. Real estate is like 20% of their GDP, which is just kind of absurd.
Yeah.
If you look at, you know, how much housing they have built, they have enough housing for everyone in the country and then some. So that's been a big bubble, but they put a lot of restrictions on that at a kind of a national level. Some of the cities and provinces have been trying to even cheat on that and trying to loosen it back up, and the states kind of crack back down on them. So you'll see where maybe a city comes out and loosens restrictions on housing, and then they have to come back out the next day and say, just kidding, because I'm assuming someone from the Chinese Communist Party put in a phone call and said, no, you're not doing that. So they have tried to keep real estate from getting too crazy, because it's really the only good place your average Joe and China can really put money. So they've kind of clamped down on that, as well as shadow banking. If you kind of just look at the levels of shadow banking, it's gone down a lot. They had those wealth management products, which were
right. Sort
of, you know, financial weapons of mass destruction that were really scary for their economy, and those have gotten crushed. And in fact, a lot of, you know, just middle class people in China that had money in those literally lost everything. There are people that lost their life savings and no one came to the rescue. They just lost everything in those.
Hey, Chase, let me stop you again. Now, hopefully, this will reflect my humility or ignorance, one of the two. I've been one of those guys that's thrown around that term wealth management product. And I've got to make a confession here. I don't have a complete understanding of exactly what those are. Can you break those down for us and just, again, a quick and dirty definition of what those wealth management products are and what they do or what they're trying to do?
Yeah, the easiest way to think of them is, and they were kind of packaged together, and there was a lot of risk in them, but they were sold as like a fixed income product. So they were sold as being no risk and having a fixed income, and the yield that they would pay out would be significantly higher than what you could get at a bank. So, you know, a lot of people poured into those. It's like, no risk, higher yield than I can get in a bank.
Yeah,
but in reality, the underlying assets were very risky.
It's sounding a little bit like a CDO.
Yeah, you can think of it in a similar way, where you just bundled some trash and then sold it as you know, great and nothing to worry about.
Oh, yeah, we've seen that story before. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got this now. Do you think, do you think these reforms are one of the reasons that we've seen the China slowing? And then the next question would be, how, you know, if we're really taking the reform seriously, how far are they willing to go with this? How far are they willing to, I guess, depress their own economic output? And then where is the real danger of the PBOC, the People's Bank of China? Where is the danger? Where is the breaking point? Where do they lose control of this?
Yeah, good question. As far as how far they're willing to go, I think that's the kind of the $1 million question macro right now. And in my opinion, you know, President Xi is willing to go far, but I'm not sure if a lot of the other power players and people that have gotten rich on this system are willing to go as far as he is. Something your listeners may or may not be familiar with is something referred to as the middle income trap. And that's something that a lot of economists have talked a lot about when it comes to China. And that's basically, you know, a theory of economic development where wages in a country, they kind of rise to the point to where their growth potential for their exports and their low-skilled manufacturing kind of end up running out and getting exhausted before they are able to start building higher productivity, you know, more innovation, higher value chain industries. And it's something that China's really facing down right now. We always think about this huge economy. They're inevitably going to pass the United States, but the reality is, if you look at per capita income in China, it's really low. So the per capita income there is about $9,000 per person. And to escape the middle income trap, they need to be about $13,000. So if you're sitting at the top of this structure, you're looking at, we have to really grow our innovation. We have to kind of put this old model to bed where we just build a bunch of stuff. We print money and we build roads and bridges and railways. And that's all they've done really in the last 30 years, is just kept doing more and more of that. And it's worked great, but you reach a point where there's no more bridges or roads or high rises to build. And they've kind of reached that point. So they have to really go up the value chain here quickly in order to get that per capita income a lot higher, or they're just going to kind of plateau and have, you know, a lost decade or two similar to Japan. So that's why they should take these reforms seriously. But at the same time, you know, a lot of important people in China have made themselves wildly wealthy and powerful by using that old model they need to get past. So if those people are able to put enough pressure on Xi and China to, you know, have another huge stimulus where they go and build a bunch more stuff, then they're not going to escape the middle income trap before they get old, because their demographics are horrific. So yeah, it really comes down to that internal fight between the people that would like to see that reform and the people that would rather just get, you know, further, just get richer in the next 5-10 years.
Right. Well, okay, so we got to take a quick break, but we're going to be right back. Thank you for sticking with us. And we've got more with Chase Taylor coming right up after the break. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH. All right, welcome back to the show. And we're going to continue our conversation with Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro Research. And before we get into it, I want to pick up where we left off with the middle income trap in China. But really quickly, macro research. One of the things that I take for granted sometimes is we might probably have some listeners sitting there going, what is macro research? One of the reasons that we connected, Chase, is because you and I share a similar opinion. I don't really believe, I guess I shouldn't say that. There's a lot of different ways to look at this. But I'm one of those guys that is a big believer and a big follower of macroeconomics. When we talk about macro research, we're referring to macroeconomics, meaning that we believe that the big shifts, right, the big, you know, China slowing, China growing, the big shifts really drive investments and drive capital flows. And that the reason we pay attention to macroeconomic research is, like I explained to our clients, I would much rather be swimming with the current than against it. Now, having said that, I'm sure you and I could both agree that I don't think that there's been a time in financial history where macro has been more complicated and probably more important. And so, you know, like I said, I know we're of like mind there, that you got to know from a top down perspective what's really going on in the world. And so when you hear us refer to macro, that's what we're talking about. So to get back into this conversation, though, and why China is important, you alluded to this when we started this conversation. Correct me if I'm wrong, but over the last 10 years, China has made up 50% of the global economic growth. And the reason, right, is the reason that Chase and I are focused on China is because when we've got a world struggling to grow, the guy that's been putting up 50% of that output, he gets increasingly more and more important. And if he starts slowing, we've got significant problems. And I know you agree with that. So to get back into it, Chase, we've watched the most magnificent debt experiment of all time in China, that the banks have been just printing money, backfilling companies' balance sheets, keeping companies that probably shouldn't be, solvent, keeping them solvent, keeping them in the game. This is not a true story of economic dynamism. I mean, you've certainly got a lot of people coming out of poverty into the middle class. There are real forces there. But without this massive debt printing and injecting capital into markets and basically controlling their economy, they wouldn't be nearly the force. So talking about this middle income trap, what is the linchpin? When do they lose control and quit being able to print prosperity? What is the breaking point? Or maybe we start off with signs. What are you watching to signal to you that they're losing control and that this game is coming to an end?
So what I'm really focusing on is kind of going back to your last question of, do they go with another massive stimulus, or do they, you know, and they're starting to do some stimulus now, but it looks more kind of cyclical and smaller than what I think a lot of market participants are expecting. So in my opinion, they're in a really crucial area right now where they have to get this right, and they have to get it right soon. In fact, Xi himself has said, like, they have to get a lot of these reforms in by 2020, because I think they realize that the clock is ticking here. Their retirement age population is going to be over 200 million. It's going to grow by over 200 million in the next 20 years. And their working age population is going to fall by 100 million. So,
holy smokes.
And they've already moved, you know, most of the farmers from the countryside to the cities. So all the easy buttons are pretty much over with. But, you know, if they want to, they can just print a bunch more money and build a bunch more stuff. It just isn't going to work longer term. It'll actually be sort of it'll be kind of a death knell for them if they do take that approach again, which is weird to me, because when I'm out reading other people's research and the thoughts of the folks, you know, that I see on TV, it seems like everyone expects another big splurge of stimulus, especially going into the Communist Party's 100-year anniversary in 2021 and their next party congresses in 2022. Typically, you see a lot of window dressing during those times, a lot of stimulus, so everything looks great and feels great going into big celebrations like that. But if they do too much, then in my opinion, they're really going to miss their ability to escape the middle income trap. So watching how big of a stimulus comes in the next, call it 18 months, is everything. If it's a huge stimulus, then they've really cut their nose off to spite their face. And if they keep their injections and pretty small and they keep trying to really, you know, innovate more, get more high value added industry going, then that would tell me they're taking it seriously and they have a chance to get through this slower than everyone expects, but healthier on the other side. There's a Communist Party theoretician in China that has talked about what they can't do is drink poison in order to quench their thirst.
Right.
And that kind of sums it up well. And it seems like everyone expects them to drink poison, but doesn't even realize that it is poison.
Right, right. So okay, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts. You and I haven't spoken about this. Where do you line up with the Kyle Bass take on things, that this is inevitably ends up in a massive devaluation, that it's coming sooner rather than later? I will confess that I am partial to that view just because we've seen their FX reserves dropping. We know that the current account has flipped negative for what, the first time in what, 23 years or something like that. I've described it as a debt Ponzi scheme, that as long as we've got, you know, new capital flowing in, that they can keep this going, that you see that current account flip negative, then, you know, that's kind of the beginning of trouble. Where are you on that view? Where do you agree with Bass? Where do you disagree with Bass? Kind of give me your take on that side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Kyle's done obviously a lot of great work on China. Another guy like on China's Jim Chanos, I think he's done some good work on it in the past. And I think I agree with Kyle on most everything that the way he views China. I think they do need to devalue. And I think if the RMB was left to its own devices, it would be a lot lower over time. But at the same time, I'm a little bit partial to Luke Groman's view that if they can price some of their commodity imports in RMB, if they can get someone to accept it for commodity imports, whether it's Saudi Arabia for oil or something different, that'll help ease a lot of that pressure on the current account, which would buy them a lot of time. I know Kyle is extremely, he doesn't think that's going to happen. You know,
he refers to the RMB, the yuan, which is the Chinese currency, refers it to as wampum, which I cried laughing the first time I heard it.
That is good.
Yeah.
You know, I have sort of a conspiracy theory in my head that I think could end up playing out is, I think with the way this trade war is going and more of the tech war, the Cold War aspect of it, not necessarily just trade, I think the U.S. is looking to kind of reassert the Monroe Doctrine and kind of take back control of the Western Hemisphere. And I think they would obviously really love to have Venezuela and Venezuela's oil under their umbrella. You know, and China and Russia clearly have a problem with that and they're looking to stop it. But if somehow China could get Saudi Arabia on their side and buy some oil with their wampum, and, you know, sort of in exchange for that, China and backs away from Venezuela and lets the U.S. sort of run that, then all of a sudden, to me, like, that looks like a scenario where everyone kind of wins. The Saudis can't really send much oil to the U.S. anymore because we make so much on our own, and our, you know, refineries are perfect to refine Venezuelan oil. So that kind of all makes sense. And then, you know, now Saudi has their key export market for the next 50-100 years. And if they take some RMB and then kind of recycle it back into China, then, you know, I think that could work for everyone. They're not just going to hold a bunch of RMB reserves because that would be a nightmare. But, you know, China has bought a ton of gold. So maybe they do settle those in gold or something, as Luke has kind of talked about in the past as well.
Okay, and this is a perfect example of why I wanted to have you on, because then you brought Venezuela into it. So that brought up a whole host of questions. But before we get to Venezuela's role in this whole mess, if you will, we got to take a quick break, but we will be right back with Chase Taylor from Pinecone Macro Research. So stick with us. Thanks for listening. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH. All right. Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. And let's get right back into it with Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro Research. Chase, we left off talking about China, of course. This is our China special. And by the way, you don't know this. I've been building this up for the last week or so, maybe 2 weeks, teasing it. So you know, I hope that doesn't put too much pressure on your shoulders. I'm sure you can handle it. Anyway, just
pressure makes diamonds.
That's right, man. Pressure, heat, and time. That's all we need. Anyway, but you brought Venezuela into the mix, and that really was intriguing to me, and it made me think of something that I haven't thought of before. What has prevented? And I haven't. Like I said, this is the first time it's crossed my mind. What has prevented China from interfering more directly into the Venezuela issue? Because I've heard Luke Grohman talk about it, but I haven't thought about it in this way. The reason, and for the listeners out there, the reason that we're focused on this is because all commodities now are settled in U.S. dollars, meaning to buy oil or to buy any commodity, you've got to settle the trade. You've got to make the purchase in U.S. dollars. So if you're China, you got to take your RMB, convert it to U.S. dollars, and then use those dollars to purchase the commodity. And that's one of the reasons that we're focused on the yuan, the Chinese currency, because they can keep this printing up and backfilling balance sheets and stimulating their economy and doing all this interference as long as the value of the RMB stays stable. One of the biggest threats to that is the need for outside commodities like oil. I am shocked that they haven't gotten more involved with Venezuela and almost seen that as a potential piggy bank, a way around all this, making direct deals with the Venezuelan government, getting in there, helping them bring their oil fields back online, getting production back. Why are they not interfering more directly with Venezuela right now?
So, you know, they have to a point, not as much as Russia, but, you know, they've made loans and tried to help them out, and they've backed the government. But I think something that was a big tell to me, it hasn't really played out yet, but very early after Guaido, said he was the president, China actually talked with them. They talked with the opposition, which told me they were taking very seriously the fact that he may end up taking power. You know, now we're, you know, many weeks down the road, and that's not working out very well for that, you know, Maduro still in power. But just the fact that China talked to Guaido early on, to me, was a big deal.
Yeah.
The biggest reason I would say that they haven't been more assertive or not as assertive as Russia or not coordinating with Russia on this whole thing is I still think for some reason backdoor they're really trying to get something done with Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, you know, kind of hinted and then took it back and said that wasn't true about selling oil to China in RMB, which, you know, there was clearly a shot across the bow that wasn't fake news. They meant for that to get out. But the only thing I can think of is they know that the U.S. will be much more assertive if they do something in the Western Hemisphere than what they do in the Middle East or in Asia.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense. I just trying to unravel this all. It's like it's one of the reasons we love it, right? It's this constant jigsaw puzzle that you're working on. Oh, it's always moving, and much to my chagrin. But like I said, what drives you nuts about it is also that it's like an abusive relationship, right? You keep getting sucked back into it, and it's just endlessly fascinating. Okay, so getting on to the economy at large with China, if they are pumping the stimulus right now, which they are, and not as hard as they have at previous times in the past. Why are we not seeing, and we've seen a couple big days, a couple big rallies, why are we not seeing a recovery in Chinese equities? What's going on with the Chinese market? I know that they just cleared the hurdle to be a part of the MSCI index and then came back and said, no, we don't really want to be considered a developed country yet. We're still poor. Why hasn't this bat round of stimulus been more effective in boosting Chinese equities?
So, you know, if you look at the Shanghai Composite, it's up about 25% off the bottom. It had just a beautiful technical area that it bounced off of. And even though I've been a China bear for a long time, I wrote up a big monthly report a couple months back, and you know, where I just trashed China the whole time, and then I showed some charts and I was like, by the way, these charts look good. but I just don't trust Chinese equities to reflect any sort of economic reality. They're super volatile. They run on a lot of short-term margin money, and I don't put any stock in them as an economic indicator quite as much as I would, you know, in a more developed country.
Gotcha.
You know, like Druck is always used, you know, internals for the U.S. stock market to kind of figure out where the economy is going, and that's worked for, well, it's obviously worked great for him for years, but it's something I just don't like to do with China. But we are starting to see a pickup in a lot of the data in China. You know, their credit's starting to flow a little more. Their velocity of, or their M1 is finally bottomed and started to recover. So you're starting to see, and they're more tech-heavy stocks out of Shenzhen have done really well lately. Even I think compared to Shanghai, they've done even better. So they're doing okay, but I just don't trust them as an indicator.
Yeah, well, they don't exactly adhere to GAAP accounting either. No. Being able to trust the numbers out of there. I mean, well, that's just a China story in general, just trusting. Well, one of the, and this is kind of a side note, but I want to get your take on it. I have actually never been to China, although I have, I was a CFO of a company that conducted quite a bit of business in China, so I'm very familiar with the business dealings. One of the interesting things to me that came out in, this was just the last few months. You probably know the source because you're way even more on top of this stuff than I am. The PBOC came out and said that the official NPL rate in China was 1.8%. And I looked at that right out of the gates because we're hearing from, what is it, Miles Kwok, I believe is the name. If I'm butchering that name, mm-hmm. Feel free to jump in there and tell me. But, you know, you've got the guys like Miles Kwok, expat of China, you know, essentially, or at least he claims, running for his life, basically. And all these very, very reliable resource or research guys and very knowledgeable guys with boots on the ground that have spent time there. And they've all, you know, you're talking about NPL rates, you know, as low as 20-25, as high as 45. I've heard some estimates. I believe Miles Kwok said it was 40 or slightly above 40. Then the PBOC comes out, says NPL rate, non-performing loan rate. So for those of you at home, people that aren't paying their bills or paying the interest on their debts, let alone principal, but yeah, just not paying the bills. And they come out, they say it's 1.8. The biggest issue I had with that number and the big head scratcher to me was I thought that they would make a more realistic lie, because how is it possible? The one thing I don't think anybody would argue about China, even China bulls, is that there is massive, maybe unprecedented amounts of excess capacity in that economy. How can you have excess capacity of that size and NPL rates at 1.8? Am I wrong to tie that together? Am I wrong to sit there and say that is very, those are incredibly incongruent data pieces? Or am I off base? And if so, how?
No, you're definitely spot on with that. And at the end of the day, none of us know what it actually is, but it is definitely significantly higher than that. The 1.8 number is absurd. And I think that maybe BIS has done a little bit of looking into how many zombie companies there are in China. So, you know, if the state doesn't like the way things are going, they just go tell the banks, hey, just keep rolling over loans. Like, so maybe they're 1.8 if you took into account how many of them, you know, the government was going to just force the banks to keep rolling over. But at the end of the day, their non-performing loans are significantly higher than that.
Okay, so now to get a little bit more, and it's good to hear you say that, because I just remember looking at that going, wait a second. You know, when we were just as a background, when I was the CFO for about 14 months of a company right in the heart of the shale boom. So, you know, 2012, 2013 area. It was an interim role, stepped in to help them get their stuff squared away. And you know, I could do a whole episode on that experience. But we were making these oil tanker trailers, right, for specifically designed to operate in the Bakken, because all the existing oil trailers were made out of aluminum. These guys were getting, you know, in 15 degree below zero with a full load in the tank. They were getting these things off road, right, because they're driving right to the wellhead. There weren't, you know, that thing exploded so fast there weren't roads. And those tanker trailers were designed for highways, right? I mean, all the oil in the United States was traditionally down in Texas, so flat, warm temperatures. They're getting them in there at 10, 15 degrees below zero off off road, and it was literally ripping these brand new trailers apart. And you know, these are $150,000-$160,000 oil haulers. So we started against my again, I don't want to get too deep into it, but against my wishes, our owner, in his infinite wisdom, decided that we need to expand globally and we need to start having these things manufactured in China. When we went over there to do that, they basically showed us like three brand new factories that were completely outfitted, and nobody would ever put anything through them. And that just boggled my mind, because I was sitting there going, look, somebody owns the paper on this, right? And if they're sitting there with nothing going through them, you know, that's the definite, they've got to be non-performing loans. I mean, nobody would, you know, no rational person would allocate capital in that manner. And it's just, it's just befuddling to me that they could possibly have, like you said, it's a nonsense number. We've already established that. But I you know, we talk about these phantom cities or ghost cities or whatever the term is. And I don't think people really grasp the magnitude of the excess capacity. What is the, I have to believe that the Communist Party in China has got some plan for that excess capacity, or a way to put it into motion. What is their plan there? Are they just not worried about it? Is it just dig a hole and fill another one up? And, you know, these people don't go to the bathroom without a plan. What is the plan there? How do they plan on dealing with this excess capacity issue?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think they have a good plan to deal with it. I think how they got here makes plenty of sense. It was, you know, literally their entire economic model was to do this. They're doing the same thing. A lot of people don't realize this, but China's doing the same thing that the Soviet Union did and the same thing that Japan did. And essentially, you know, the way to have a 30-year economic boom the way they're doing is you just hold down the household share of GDP. You make it to where, you know, loans and inflation, or, you know, so like say inflation is running 15% in China, you know, a decade ago or whatever. Well, the deposit rate for your average person was, you know, 2% at the bank. So you're just destroying wealth of individuals, and they're sucking up all that excess, you know, and you're calling it savings. And then everyone thinks the country saved a lot of money, and they funnel all that into, you know, the big state-owned firms, and then they go out and build tons of stuff. So it looks great. It feels great. It does work great for, you know, a few decades until you get saturated. And they clearly are saturated, like you're saying, with all the overcapacity. Jim Chanos actually calculated that China was going to spend about 3% of global GDP,
wow,
on excess housing. So not housing that was needed for people, but speculative excess housing. And famously, he talked about how there was a 5x5 office available for every man, woman, and child in the country. So the office space, the housing space is just incredible. That, you know, there's dozens of ghost cities, and to their credit, you know, a lot of the ghost cities that people have, you know, criticized in the past, they actually did fill up pretty quickly. So sometimes those work out, sometimes they don't, but I don't think they really cared if they didn't work out, because they were just maximizing the old model. And, you know, if you're a local government, you get a mandate to get X GDP, so you're going to get it one way or another, whether that's to build, you know, some new stadium that's never going to get used or whatever. You know, you're going to hit your target so you don't get in trouble.
Right, right. Okay.
And that's what we've seen.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we got to take another break. And for those of us, for those of you listening to this show, we've got to cut things off here. We're going to continue this conversation. If you want to hear the end of the interview, you can go to our podcast page. Just Google Know Your Risk Radio podcast, or you can go to Bulwark Management or bulwarkcapital.com, or just Google it. Like I said, you can find it. We've got plenty of podcasts all over the place. But anyway, so this is the end of the show. Thank you for joining us. But like I said, you can pick it up at the on the podcast and catch the end of the interview. So Chase, stick with us. And we'll be right back. Thanks for listening. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH. All right, welcome back to the show, and thanks for joining us for the conclusion to our interview here with Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro Research. Again, Chase, this is our Chinese special. We're digging into the dirt here and trying to really understand things. And this is something that, again, I you and I are simpatico on this. And it's something that I like to do with all of my investments, is try to take the other side of it. So if we're going to look at the China scenario and we're going to sit there and put our bull hats on and we're going to envision a scenario where what you and I think blows up in our face and China's able to pull it off, how could they make this work? I kind of view, and again, you know, I want you to speak your piece, even if that disagrees with me, but I kind of look at China as almost the sovereign version of Tesla, where I'm looking at it and scratching my head going, you know, look, my career has proven to me that I can always be wrong. I've been wrong enough. How do they possibly pull this off? Is it possible? And if so, how would that happen? How would they go about keeping this train on the rails and, you know, following through with their plans, right? This being the road to Chinese global dominance for the next 100 years. How can that scenario play out?
Yeah, I don't expect it to by any means, but I think the only way that it could happen would be for them to truly win the tech war. And that, to me, that's the, I think we are in a cold war with China. I think it's going to stay that way for a long time. And it's mostly focused on technology. If they can become the world's leader in, you know, AI and machine learning and biotechnology and creating, you know, building new defense systems, all the new technology that we think is coming down the line in the next, you know, 15, 20 years, if they just start dominating all of those, then they could do well. But the chances of that happening are very slim, I think. But that, in my opinion, it's their only hope. It's their only way they can grow enough to deleverage and kind of pass the baton from their old economy to their new economy they're trying to get to. They're really struggling. You know, they're trying to go to the consumer-based economy, and that's just not working very well. So,
well, a tech
miracle is the only way.
Yeah, but these transitions becoming a consumer-based economy, that's one of the other issues I've had with China is you don't just push a button and convert to a consumer-based economy or a consumption-based economy. These things typically happen over generations, over, you know, 20, 40, 30, 40-year periods of time. And I guess what this is leading to is, how did they see it? Again, another thing that's baffling to me is I look at this whole strategy of theirs, and my first thought is, look, guys, you know, I hate to break it to you, but this has been tried before, and even if everything plays out perfectly, I don't see how this blows up. What in your opinion, assuming that our take on things is correct, and I think it is, just because we're looking at the facts on the ground and just saying, hey, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. But what do you think that their vision was? How did they think that they were going to convert this? Was it all hanging on their belief that they could convert to a consumer-based economy at the push of a button? Were they that naive? What is their take on it? And from their perspective, do you think that they think that things are going according to plan? Are they sitting back thinking now they've made some mistakes? From their side of it, that's the thing I've never been able to wrap my head around, because had I been there in that initial meeting, I had to raise my hand and been like, hey, fellas, this is going to blow up. People have tried this before. But I don't assume that they're stupid people. What do you think that their idea was? And if we're right, where were they wrong? Where did it start going off the rails?
Yeah. I think it really started going off the rails was this. They were way too late to transition. You know, I think everyone looks at the Belt and Road Initiative or the Silk Road as, you know, I think people look at it too much from the political standpoint. You know, they're trying to get some geopolitical and strategic advantages by making all these relationships and loans and, you know, taking over some ports. That's all great. I think it's a nice side benefit to China, but what that was all about, in my opinion, was exporting all of that, you know, that slack in their economy where they built up all these excesses. Like, there's nothing else to build in China, so let's just go build it all over the world, and, you know, we'll get some good loans in there, and maybe some people will default, and we'll take over some strategic assets as well, and that's a nice side benefit. But at the end of the day, if you run out of stuff to build and you just go start looking for other places to build stuff. So I think that's why the U.S. is finally coming around and realizing that, hey, we have to compete with them on this because that's buying them a lot of time, and it's going to give them at least a possibility of making a legit transition to becoming a real competitor. So now the U.S. is stepping in to try and, you know, compete with them on that a little bit. So I think everyone, a lot of people view the Belt and Road Initiative as this great thing. I think it actually illustrates the fact that they overplayed their hand. They waited too long to really transition their own economy. And I think in the last 5-10 years, they've gone into overdrive trying to steal technology, to try and like really bring their tech industry up a notch, you know, to get it to where they have a chance at actually really transitioning this thing before they get old and just kind of fade, you know, fade the way Japan did with lost decades and debt saturation.
Could something I've bantied, thrown around a bit, and I've been assured by people that are probably smarter than me, that I'm wrong. But one of the ideas that I kept coming to was, do you think that this could have been China sitting back and watching us pile on the debt and watching Europe pile on the debt and said, you know, let's play this money printing stimulus game, this debt, you know, bubble inflation. Let's play this game. Let's print a bunch of nonsense money, and then let's take that money and buy up as many real assets as we possibly can. And when the game comes to a conclusion, they might determine that our currency isn't worth anything. But if we've got a disproportionate amount of hard assets around the world, we've already alluded to the fact that China's buying gold like it's going out of style. Do you think that their strategy could have been that nefarious from the start, or was this part of that transition? I just throw these monstrous questions at you with 18 different sides to them. So let's break it down simply. A, do you think this was the plan all along, that it this nefarious plan, like I, you know, my, and again, I'm not saying this is my view, but it's something I've thought of, this kind of Dr. Evil approach to the world, that, hey, we're going to exploit these loopholes that you guys are all using. We're just going to do it to the 10th power and ramp it up, and we're going to use this silly money to buy real assets. Do you think that was the approach all along? And, or B, is this been an adjustment that they've made along the road? And do you think that there's some validity to that idea?
Yeah, I think it's very possible. And I think if that did happen, then it was likely, you know, in response to 08. So, and, gotcha. You know, I wouldn't blame them if they saw what the U.S. did in 08. Granted, they did what they did after 08 was kind of made what we did look small in a lot of ways. So, and they kind of did, you know, pull the global economy through. But yeah, I think it's very possible that they realized, like, okay, the end game of this whole thing is everyone's going to print a bunch of money and it might end up being a giant currency war. And the best thing to do is to try and buy real stuff at a bargain price as long as we can. And, you know, they kind of have been doing that ever since. So it's very possible. And if they did that, if the end game, you know, works out to where everyone prints into oblivion and ends the long-term debt cycle, at least, you know, you do have some real assets to show for it on the other end. But the problem with that is everything's relative and everything's on a timeline. So, you know, you could have a last man standing kind of issue where the idea is to not blow up first, you know, to blow up last. And then you, it's kind of like in Monopoly, where if you just kind of, you know, hold your powder until some other people go out, you can snatch up their assets. So, you know, you don't want to go out first. So maybe that has been their plan, but if they are too aggressive with it and they go out of the game first, then it was all for naught.
Gotcha. Okay, so to wrap things up, and I don't want to interject anything in here because I legitimately like to hear your thoughts, and I think that everybody else, all the listeners, could benefit from hearing it. You know, and you can include China in this as well. But one of the things that I like to do with every single guest that we have on here is go, okay, we've covered this subject. Now give us kind of the blow-by-blow of what you think is the most important thing in the world right now. We got Jamie Dimon out talking about how this cycle can go on for several more years. You've got other guys on the Uber Bowl saying that we're only halfway through this. Kind of give me a macro view of what you're watching, where you think we are in the cycle, and with you, the way you're looking at things, what are the things that you're keeping your eye on? What do you think are the things that are going to be the most important over the next 12, 16, 18 months? Kind of give me an idea of what Chase Taylor and Pinecone Macro Research's view of the world is and what you're focused on.
And so I think what's really important to watch in the months ahead is going to be inflation. It's starting to feed in a little bit more than people expect, but growth is weakening. So I think we're going to continue to see growth weaken, but I think inflation is going to stay a little bit stubborn compared to what people are expecting. And I would not be surprised if we saw a very shallow recession going into next year, but I also wouldn't be surprised if we slowed down to, 1%-ish, 0.5%, and then kind of made our way higher. And that's kind of the shorter term and just small cycle view. But what I think is most important for people to really start thinking about is a long-term cycle and where we may or may not be in that. And MMT has kind of taken the world by storm. And I think it's really important to view the long-term cycle as if that was just an inevitability where the government is going to end up creating massive amounts of debt that will lead to inflation. And it's the only way this can even end. But the thing is, I think MMT-like policies could end up pushing this cycle out much further than people expect. And I think it could push stocks much higher than people expect. It's hard for me to imagine politicians kind of letting this thing fall apart on their watch. And so I think they'll keep kicking the can. And every time you get up to the can, it takes a bigger kick. And eventually that big kick is going to be taking away the link of government debt to interest payments, because that's like the governor on the government debt is the fact that, hey, eventually those interest costs get really high. But, we impose that on ourselves. There's no reason we have to pay interest on debt, whether the Fed buys it all, then all of a sudden you don't have to pay interest. Or if you just change the law to where Congress can create money on their own and it's not even debt, they just create it. I think that's where we're headed. And I think that will create some fake prosperity and a lot of big moves in asset prices that a lot of people aren't going to expect before it does likely end badly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm very much of the old school or Austrian mindset when it comes to economics. And I'm very much a business cycle believer. Yet at the same time, we have to sit back and acknowledge that we have two developed, or, well, China's claiming they're not developed, but we have our own thoughts on that. But we've seen these two major economies, China and Australia, go now, 25 years without a recession in either country. And so I would call those cycle-less economies at this point. And they've proven that the business cycle can be massively elongated and extended. I don't think it disappears. My personal thought is you can space it out. The longer you space it out, the more turbulent the turns are going to be, right? It's just, the guy from Artemis Capital had a great quote where he said, you don't get rid of risk. You just transform it into something else and delay it. And so that's kind of my look at it. But, I am terrified with record valuations and the way this market has run up nonstop. But one of the things that I've said on the show regularly is, look, we're going to stay disciplined and conservative, but we're not going to dump all of our stocks in anticipation of the end, because this can be extended much longer. And China and Australia are the proof. Do you think that's going to happen here? I mean, could the government play this out another, through Fed intervention? Could we see an elongated cycle? Could they roll this out another 10, 12 years? Is that possible? And do you think that elongated cycle that we've seen in Australia and China, is that the way the mainstream financial media reports it, is this, recessionless economic miracle, or is it purely just a product of central bank intervention? And could it happen here? Could we see this Fed put run us out another 10, 12 years in this cycle?
Absolutely. And I think that my base case is that this cycle will run at least that long. There's a lot of room left. I think you can go back and read what's the famous book, trading book. Jim Rogers was in it, Market Wizards. And,
yes.
The book is from the 80s, and Jim Rogers is in there. He's a brilliant investor, and he's warning about, imminent doom because of government debt. Or if you actually go look at, Stephanie Kelton's presentations, the MMT professor, she shows like all these newspaper cartoons going back when people were warning of,
the imminent danger of government debt when it was $8 billion. And here we are, you know, $21, $22 trillion, and we still don't have inflation. You know, interest rates are at all-time lows pretty much across the world. So I think MMT people are right that the real limiting factor is inflation. And I think the government will be able to get in a lot of crazy spending policies before that inflation actually takes the keys away from this whole situation. So I think it may be 5, 10, 15 years before, even 20 years possibly, before, you know, we really have the inflation hits that forces a big reset, but forces balance sheets that are, you know, of these zombie companies to be dealt with in a meaningful way. So I think all this stuff could get a lot crazier before it's all over with.
Yeah, no, and my feeling is that it will just be, you alluded to something, or at least I thought you did, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you alluded to something earlier in the interview about, you know, political will. You don't think the politicians are going to allow it to happen. The other issue I've got, and I felt the same way about Jerome Powell, not to completely circle back to the beginning of our conversation, but I felt the same way about Jerome Powell in the beginning. And then I watched him capitulate there at the end of 2018, the end of last year. And one of the things that went through my mind is, rather than just beating the desk and being an anti-Fed, anti-central banker guy, you got to take a step back and look at it and just go, guys, at least from my perspective, we've taken the option to live in financial reality. We've taken it off the table. If he were to play it the way he technically should and adhere to what I believe the Fed's real mandate is, which is not sustaining the S&P and not floating asset prices. I actually think the full employment mandate's a joke. You may disagree with me, but I just think it's ridiculous. Because I feel like that in and of itself is recognizing that you don't want free markets to do their thing. And I'm obviously, like you, a capitalist and a free market guy. But looking at this and saying, they can't do the right thing, right? I mean, the pain caused from that, if they quit injecting capital and they quit running to the rescue and they quit responding to asset prices, it benefits nobody, right? Are we so far down the path that reality is no longer an option?
Yeah, that's my view. That's absolutely my view. If you go back to, you know, 2008, 2009 period, whenever we actually did see some deleveraging on total debt in the United States, it's like this tiny, small dip on the chart, and that created this chaos.
Right.
And so, you know, and we've gone straight up since then, mostly because of government debt and corporate debt. But that makes you realize that if they stop just adding more and more money and leverage to the system, then the whole thing ends. And there's no way they're going to do that on purpose or, you know, voluntarily. Not when they know that they could, whatever it is, you know, print money and pay off student loans with it, or something like that, that's going to, you know, buy them more time. And the best way to get past all the debt to begin with, in their eyes at least, is going to be to inflate it away. You can have a multi-generational slow deflation to get out of it, or you can have, you know, one inflationary spasm to kind of reset all these debt levels. And one of them works politically and one doesn't. So I assume they'll take the easy route and the one that, you know, kind of resets the thing faster. And it's easy to blame inflation on other people, and that's what they'll do. You know, you talk about, you can't just kind of pound the table about, you know, how much you disagree with this. And I'm a free market guy. I'm also an Austrian. I find just the fact that the Fed is a bunch of PhDs trying to model the economy and run it from the top down is insane. It's like trying to organize, you know, a complex adaptive system like the ocean and play God with it. To me, it's crazy. But at the end of the day, that's what we have. And there's a lot of perma bears that have sat out, you know, a really great bull market for 10 years. And, you know, we see them on Twitter. They're always angry. They're always rooting for the stock market to collapse. I started calling them financial justice warriors.
Oh, I love that.
Seen on Twitter.
Yeah, I love that.
They want justice more than they want to make money. And I get it, because I come from the same kind of mindset. But, you know, if I was just watching, I'd be just like them. But I'm not just watching. I'm trying to make money. And the only way to do that is to understand the reality of the situation and invest in what's likely to happen, not what I want to happen.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And I have fought that night and day by my or constantly over the last 10 years. And one of the things I've had several clients look at me and go, Zach, I heard your recent radio show, and I agree with you, and all these signs are troubling. So why are we in stocks at all? And I look at them and I say, look, you know, we have to acknowledge that if this was normal, if this was 1960s, right, and we were on the gold standard, all that kind of, I wouldn't have a dime in stocks right now. There's no question, but it's not. And we have to acknowledge that reality. And like you said, I can sit back and throw things around the office and get ticked. And the reason I use throw things around the office is because I have done that. I've gotten so frustrated with it. You know, you get these horrible economic reports and the Dow surges 300 points because that means more stimulus, and you're just beating your head against a wall. And finally, I said, you know what? You got to roll with it. It reminds me of the old scene in Friday Night Lights, you know, at the end of the movie when they're giving the kid the ball in the final play of the game, and the injured running back tells him, hey, don't fight it. Roll with it, right? You can't mm-hmm. fight against it. You got to roll with it. And I know you know this story as a guy that grew up in Texas and played high school ball in Texas. Is that kind of your take? I mean, are we on the same page there? I think we are. Just looking at it and going, hey, yeah, it's ridiculous. It's insanity, but it's going to keep rolling. You got to roll with it. You can't fight it. We don't get paid. You know, we're not getting paid in morality points here. We got to keep a sober view on what's going on, but we also have to be realistic about what's driving markets. And normal economic forces aren't. They haven't been for over a decade now, and you just got to kind of accept it. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, as crazy as everything is, policy or valuations, at the end of the day, you have to have a catalyst for it to change. And
right.
It goes back to inflation. I think that's the real catalyst for it. Any of that to change is inflation that isn't just kind of high, but is scary high, like where the Fed starts looking like the Fed is losing control of their ability to contain it. That's when all of a sudden you start looking at those valuations and seeing like, okay, we're starting to see a catalyst where this could, you know, go the other way. And, you know, if you go back and look at like the CAPE ratio that Japan had, you know, it was like, I don't know, roughly three times the highest we've ever had. So that kind of shows you where in the U.S. there's probably a lot of room to move higher, possibly if we see super inflationary type, you know, spending practices that don't lead to inflation right away. Then they'll just keep doing it, and
yeah,
you know,
no, yeah, and I don't mean yeah, no, and I don't mean to cut you off, but you triggered something in my memory. And we got to wrap this up pretty quick, but just before we go, you triggered something in my memory because one of the things, are valuations absurd? Yes. Are they way more absurd than they look? Certainly when you're looking at forward PE ratios, which I don't put any stock in myself. We have a joke on the show, which is forward PE ratios are what you cite when you're trying to sell a stock. Trailing 12 is what you cite when you're looking to buy a stock. But if you look at the periods of time where even the PE ratios like in 2000 were significantly higher than they were. And then if we just took a step back and described what governments have done specifically here in the United States, where debt has gone, what they've used to stimulate the economy, the policies of the Fed, it would make sense. It would be poetic justice, and it would make sense that the end of this rally would see record valuations rivaling, if not surpassing, the ones in 2000, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. You nailed it. And if we do see new lows in rates, especially, you know, if we go to if the Fed ends up going to negative interest rates and printing a bunch of money, and, you know, maybe they start pushing that into the real economy instead of just bank balance sheets or something. But if that happens, you know, why wouldn't we see record high valuations that made everything in history look crazy? If you're a pension fund and you know that you're going to get absolutely nothing buying bonds, and you know stocks are running higher because they become the new you know, safe haven, then you know I would expect pensions and all the big money to go flowing into equities and out of bonds. Let the Fed buy them all, because that's probably what'll happen.
Yeah, well, and to some degree we've seen that happen. So anyway, Chase, hey, awesome. I'm glad we finally got you on. I hope you'll be kind enough to join us again in the future. And it's been awesome talking to you. People, if they want to follow you, Twitter is probably the best way to do that, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so and they can get you at Pinecone. Give me your Twitter handle.
Yeah, just at Pinecone Macro.
Okay.
And website's pineconemacro.com. Easy.
Gotcha. Yeah, and I would strongly suggest all of you to do it. I love the way that Chase breaks things down in plain language and plain English, and doesn't try to dress them up in too much, you know, PhD, CFA type talk, and says it straight. So anyway, thanks again for joining us. Can't recommend a follow on Twitter for you any more than I have. I think it's an invaluable resource, and we look forward to having you on again.
Yeah, it was a pleasure, and I look forward to being on again. Thanks, Zach.
All right, pal. We'll talk to you soon. All right, guys, we got to run, but thank you so much for listening. As always, you can join us next week and go to the podcast and catch all of our episodes. But we got to run. Thank you for joining us. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.